This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, we are joined by Ben Kahn. Ben is the writer, creator of the current comic book series Heavenly Blues, published by Scout Comics. He previously wrote and published a graphic novel, Shaman. And we're glad to have you with us tonight, Ben. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm excited for this.
Before we get into the works themselves, I was just curious a little bit about your path, your journey to comic book writing. How did you get started? Who were some of your influences? If you had any, just anything you want to talk about is how you got to where you are today.
My path is weird and out of order. Like, if someone was to pitch my path as a movie, I'd be like, this pacing is goddamn nonsense. So I started making webcomics when I was 15 and started actually reading comics when I was 18. So I kind of first came out through like just doing like a little fun webcomic, but then it really wasn't until college that I started reading like DC and Marvel and Image and Vertigo and Dark Horse. And I completely fell in love with the medium in college. It just really became an absolute obsession. And it was during college that I decided I wanted to try to become a writer. And honestly, just that felt like a switch going off. And from there on, pretty much every decision I made is just like, well, how does this help me get closer to making comic books?
So is comic books your only outlet for writing, or do you write for any other medium?
I've written a few television scripts in the past, usually working with a writing partner on those, and those are fun, but comics are a truly, truly special medium to me. They are absolutely my medium of choice. It just feels like the medium I can accomplish the most, and the one that is, like, from a storytelling perspective, just the absolute wealth, the infinite canvas of ideas and characters and stories and genres and settings that are attainable in comics versus other mediums. And also, just from a practical standpoint, it seemed like the medium that I could most easily, or like within my means, go from I have an idea to I now have a finished product in my hands. So it's a special medium to me, but it also felt like a practical choice.
On your webcomics, that is something I'm not too familiar with.
Yeah, that's intentional. Yeah, that's really on purpose.
You did the writing. Did you also do the artwork for it as well when you did that?
Quote unquote artwork, finger quotes the size of a mountain. It was a sprite comic using the graphics from a Kingdom Hearts Game Boy game.
Oh my gosh.
So someone took the Game Boy game and ripped every sprite sheet, every background, every character, and put them in like easily manipulatable like sheets. And I just took those from the internet and just made little comics out of those in Microsoft Paint.
Clever. That's clever, I would have to say. But
I can't take credit. It was like a style. It was a fairly prominent style of webcomics for a hot minute in like the early 2000s. So I wasn't the first. There was like bigger comics that had been done. So do you know Atomic Robo, that comic?
I have heard the name, but I'm not familiar with it.
So that writer, he started out doing a webcomic that was, again, a sprite comic where he took the sprites from the first Final Fantasy game and added dialogue and backgrounds and made a webcomic out of it. So that he actually started sprite comics too, and he was my big inspiration to start a webcomic way back in the day. And that was, look, I made this comic between, like, I was 15 when I started it. It was the mid-2000s. South Park and Chappelle's Show ruled the land. It was teenage shock comedy, is what it was.
Now, were they set in that same world that the sprites came from, or did you totally throw them out of context?
Fuck no, completely out of context. I kept the names and stole the art and chucked out everything else. As it were, it was just a comic about like seven sociopaths on a Fox like Big Brother style reality show.
Well, here at the Nerdy Legion, we don't use Google. We use DuckDuckGo. So if we DuckDuckGo it, we're not going to find it when we search the interwebs.
I'm perfectly okay with that.
Okay.
Because the early 2000s were a very different time than the late 2010s.
Yes.
Especially indeed. In terms of just how angry the internet will get at you.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds great, though. I mean, everybody's got to start somewhere, and at least that got you
what
some
that
exposure.
Gave me, what that really gave me was, A, it taught me how to use Photoshop, which I have yet to have a single job where knowing Photoshop hasn't been a huge advantage.
Right.
And B, just the fact that because it was stolen backgrounds and it was stolen character art, the only thing about this comic that was actually original was the dialogue. So for this comic to work, like, and I ended up doing it for like 7 years and over 700 strips, the only way it worked, I had to put everything I had into the dialogue. And it really, the fact that the entire story, for the most part, had to be told through dialogue, because it was just characters with no faces and pixelated poses standing across a room from each other. So the entire thing had to be dialogue-based. So it really, without even meaning to, I think it just became such great training for just writing dialogue and writing different characters and figuring out dynamics and different voices and like comedy and comedic timing. And I think those are the lessons I've been really able to carry into Shaman and Heavenly Blues.
Oh, so you kind of built how to do dialogue, and then once you've got that nailed down, because in your head you know how to, you're laying out the page and all that, so you don't have to script that. And so now when you're doing comics, you know how to do the dialogue, and the next step was learning how to script it such that your artist can capture what you're picturing for your characters?
Oh, yeah, and not just that, but just thinking on, like, such a wider canvas. I mean, with the webcomic, again, like 700 strips, I'm going to say 600 of them were literally four panels of two characters standing across from each other, having just back and forth dialogue. And to go from that being my limit to just, you know, just a cavalcade of the impossible. I'm like, skeletons and monsters and everybody's teleporting. Oh, and we got to do five period pieces in one story. It's crack. I can't get enough of it. I'm like, wait, I can do this? Okay, well, I got to do that. Like all the random stuff that's been in my head, it's like, yeah, just do it. Do it. Nothing's stopping you. Go for it. And so just learning how to be completely unleashed while restraining myself to the point where I can actually finish a script. But just the sense of going from being so limited into what a comic could be to having what really just feels like infinity at my fingertips.
Excellent. Well, you said you started reading comics at 18, Marvel and DC Image. What were some of the, do you remember some of the titles? I mean, the first things you read and...
Oh, absolutely. I can tell you exactly what got me into reading, like what my first books were. My first superhero title was Runaways. An ex-girlfriend in high school had introduced that to me, and like I read the trades of that early. But then what got me into a store reading monthly was Jeff Johns' Green Lantern and Grant Morrison's Batman and Robin.
Oh, two good ones. Very good ones. I love Morrison's Batman and Robin.
Yeah, and Jeff Johns, I came in like right when they were like the build up for Blackest Night was like going into full pitch. So my first ever big comic event was Blackest Night. And honestly, I don't think anything has ever quite matched that for me. Maybe Secret Wars.
Now, was that before or after the War of Light? Because you'll say you came into it after they already had all the different colors of the spectrum.
So when I came into it, during War of Light. I came in like right after Sinestro Corps War had ended is when I started like reading monthly.
Okay. Right. That's when he really expanded the characters and this the whole Green Lantern universe there. So yeah, that was a great time to come in.
Yeah, like I think the first appearance of the Blue Lanterns was the first issue I like picked, single issue, like I just picked up in a store. I was like, I'm just going to dive in. So, and then because there were so many trades to read back then, what really got me, and I already loved the DC Universe, is from Batman the Animated Series and the Justice League cartoons, and you know, the 2/3 of the Dark Knight trilogy had come out at this point. But what really got me into, especially the comics version of the DC Universe as this whole giant place, was 52. So Geoff Johns, Grant Morrison, Mark Waid, and Greg Rucka being given free reign for 52 issues with B and C list characters that they could do with whatever they want. I mean, God, what a dream team that has never been replicated, that series. Yeah. So it's 52, but also a ton of like old school Vertigo stuff. So obviously, Sandman, Invisibles, Preacher, Why the Last Man, Watchmen. I pretty much looked at my college years and was like, yeah, I'm going to take the classes I got to take, whatever. My real education is in is in comic books, the medium, the history of them, and how to make them.
Excellent. Okay, so while you're in college, were you taking writing classes? Pointing yourself towards this?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I switched my major to English, took every fiction writing course I could find, and spent the entire time just writing stories that I wanted to do potentially as comics, and just figured, well, let me just work on them and develop them on school time. Kill two birds, one stone. Everyone else, I lived in a frat house. Everyone else was like a business or a science or an engineering major. We get to finals. Everyone's freaking out, pulling their hair out. I'm just chilling. They're like, don't you have a final paper? I'm like, I finished it. The mummy had sex with the vampire. Then he robbed her and jumped out the window. Done. I'm good.
Oh, that's excellent. And I loved that Matt Morrison's Batman and Robin. I'm a lifelong Batman fan.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like 11 years old. And that, especially with Dick Grayson as Batman, is one of my favorite runs.
I have a lot of affection for Dick Grayson as Batman, especially when he's paired up with Damian Wayne.
Yeah, that was a good.
There will always be a very large place for that run in my comics loving heart.
Well, moving on to your own work, Shaman was your first thing you've published, and you actually financed that through a Kickstarter campaign. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, the printing for that was done through Kickstarter. So I funded the actual making of the art of the book, I used Kickstarter to fund the production, to fund the printing. So Kickstarter was a roller coaster of experience. I know everyone that does a Kickstarter will say that, but it just is. There's something unique and empowering. There's something you said for when everyone tells you no and you just go like, F it, I'm just going to put it out there and try to make this thing real no matter what. And there's this something empowering to just being able to say like, wow, even when every publisher said no, I still made this book. Though when I say like every publisher said no, I do want to say like Shaman came out in 2015. And I know that feels so short ago, but really the publishing landscape has changed dramatically in just 2 years. And when I was pitching Heavenly Blues, like there's a whole crop of publishers out there now that's helping like bringing new writers and artists and new creatives to the fore that just did not exist when Shaman was being pitched. So you look at between 2015 and 2017, you have Scout, you have Black Mask, you have Vault, you have Alterna, you have Lion Forge, just this whole tier of publishing that did not exist 24 months ago.
Yeah, and those publishers you named. We're Dennis and I are reading works from all of those and from others, and yeah, it's really amazing how that has blossomed in the last two years.
Yeah, it's different now than it was. I kind of grew up in the 80s and the early 90s with comics, and the independents weren't anywhere near like the scope and the quality and just the variety that they are now.
And it's so interesting to me how the industry changed to match, because based off the publishing preferences of this whole new crop of publishers, you're seeing so many great, and what's kind of becoming almost the standard format in indie books is you're kind of seeing the rise of the 4-issue miniseries. And I feel like, again, you go back to like late 2000s, like you think you look like, oh, 5-6 issues to a trade. And now for indie books, it's like 4 is almost the standard for a very large portion of books coming out right now.
Well, is that changing, you think, the comic industry from like a monthly format to where you got to keep up with continuity, you got to keep interesting stories, you're having new writers that are changing things, and then people jump on and jump off. I know that's one of the things we've been discussing, like I think Valiant's doing that now, and I think DC came out with something not too long ago. They were going to do like books or miniseries independent of the main continuity.
Yeah, DC did a really cool 3-part Deadman series that I highly recommend. It's like Deadman in a gothic romance and had a real cool old school Vertigo horror feeling to it that I really dug. I forget the exact name of it, but it's the most recent Deadman work and it's real good. I think the reason you started to see the shift to 4 issues is a combination of issue-to-issue attrition and trade sales versus like the importance of trade sales. So I think what you have is a lot of these indies really only make a profit or become true successes when the trade is out. And I think when you get to the issue-to-issue just attrition, maybe the sales for 5 and 6 are no longer seen as that you would get from issues 5 or 6 are worth it. It's just seen, it might be seen as a poor investment when that extra content doesn't increase trade sales and in fact increases print cost. So you might feel like 4 issues is the most there. So there, I think there might be a feeling that 4 issues is the most you can do for the single issues to be worthwhile while still with the trade seen as the primary revenue driver.
And that makes a lot of sense. And like, I know 2 of my favorite publishers, Fantagraphics and Drawn and Quarterly, neither of those publishers do much in the way of monthly comics. Most of what they release are complete graphic novels, complete collections. And it seems like, and I've wondered if that is kind of where the industry is moving slowly towards.
It's hard to say. There's a strong argument. I think there is a strong argument to be made for certain kinds of stories to be done as like trade only or as graphic novels. And you can still put them through regular comic book shops, but really aggressively court like bookstores. But that kind of makes sense from a revenue perspective. But on the flip side, your marketing window becomes so much shorter. And think about it, if you just have one trade come out, you've got a week, maybe a month, let's say, be generous, say a month you have where you can go like all out and really push this thing like crazy and just be in the spotlight, be in like people's attention versus a monthly series where, again, say it's 4 issues in a trade, that's 6 months of being in the spotlight, of doing interviews, of doing reviews, of having previews, of having new art, new solicitations.
Right.
And also just even if it's not selling great in the stores, how much there's an amount of awareness and momentum that just being on those shelves may accrue that is very difficult, if not impossible, to truly quantify. So it's one of the, so there's no easy answers, and it makes sense to switch to a trade only model. But at the same time, you do have to balance it with this massive loss in marketing opportunity.
Interesting. So I had not thought of that.
So from a writer standpoint, is it easier to do the 4-issue, 6-issue stories than the ongoing, because you can close the story or end the story instead of having to just keep it going?
I'd say it's easier to do miniseries because they're less heartbreaking. let me put this, way. I tried to leave Shaman on a fairly satisfying ending point. I could easily do 9 more volumes of Shaman, and it hurts thinking about how much more I need to do that I'll probably never get to do to make these character arcs and the story of the world and the characters truly complete. And that sucks versus Heavenly Blues, where, you know, I have some ideas for sequels, but they would be more sequels than continuations, where it is more like, you know what, I got an idea for this story. I'm going to come in. It's going to be 6 issues, beginning, middle, and end. And at the end of issue 6, I'm going to put my pen down and be like, yeah, story done. I did it.
Nice. So Shaman, that wasn't released as any single issues. That was just like a collection? Correct?
That was physically, it was released as a collection. Digitally, it was released in single issues on Comixology.
Okay. Oh, so you are on Comixology, so you're not just getting printed through Scout.
Shaman is on Comixology. There's currently work to try to getting the Scout comics on Comixology, but that's above my pay grade. I know it's happening. I have no idea when.
Okay, interesting.
All right, so I'm not that familiar with Shaman, and I'm pretty sure a bunch of our listeners aren't. So, what can you give us the quick synopsis that's gonna like make me run out and have to order it tonight?
Yeah, so pretty much Shaman is Rick and Morty meets John Constantine, and it's the story of a necromancer and his teenage sorceress daughter really just go on crazy, wacky, fucked up, mystical adventures, bringing dead people back to life and pissing off every superhero they meet along the way. They fight a teleporting skeleton. At one point, there's zombies versus astronauts. The zombies are the good guys. And in one issue, they bring Babe Ruth back to life to fight the real green monster.
So, pretty much just formulaic. No, I'm just teasing with that. Interesting.
It's like pretty standard, humdrum, very low-key adventures.
Yeah.
And the same artist that's doing Heavenly Blues.
Yep, that's right. That was our first collaboration together, me and Bruno. And then we liked working together so much on Shaman that pretty much the day it was finished, I asked him to work with me on Heavenly Blues.
Okay. How did you meet Hidalgo?
So the publisher for Shaman, Locust Moon Press, actually connected us together. Locust Moon had done an anthology with Dark Horse called Once Upon a Time Machine. And we kind of looked at the artists that worked on that anthology to see who might be a good fit for kind of the offbeat pop feel of the story. And Bruno's art kind of jumped out. And we reached out and we agreed. And it's been a great experience. When we did Shaman, because he's native to Spain and lives in Barcelona, the language barrier was a issue with us. So we only actually communicated through email. That was the only way we could communicate was through email when working on Shaman. But as we've worked together, the language barrier has become less of an issue. So we still haven't met face-to-face, but we instant message each other now a lot. So I would like to think that I may be blowing smoke up my own ass, but I would like to think that if you look at Shaman and Heavenly Blues, and as different and as much as I love both of those, I hope you would see me develop as a writer, Bruno develop as an artist, and the two of us develop as a team working together.
I think so. I mean, I haven't had the occasion to read Shaman yet, so I'm not, can't speak to it very much, but the writing, I know in Heavenly Blues, the first thing I thought, the word that came to me was intelligent. This is intelligent writing.
Thank you.
And yeah, I love the, you know, just some of the phrasing that you use. And
Well, every character has a different voice.
I have to spend a lot of time thinking about Isaiah's dialogue because he's way cooler than I am. So I have to think, like, what would I say if I was a way cooler person than I am?
Yeah, and I guess that's what people don't realize what's so difficult about writing is not putting the same voice and your voice into all the characters and making them different.
I'd say in Heavenly Blues, I think the characters that speak with the closest to my voice is Aaron first and Coin Counter to a much lesser degree, but still there a good chunk of the time. Isaiah, Hideki, and Amunet have, or Isaiah's got a very just, God, he's just so cool. Like, so I always try to think about ways to just be, and it's a good challenge with him because whenever I'm writing a line and I look at it and it's just like, and all it's doing is conveying information or moving the plot along, I just have to like kind of whip myself into shape and just be like, how can I do this while also just showing flair and flavor and a theatricality that to the character comes as natural as breathing.
What kind of was the genesis of this whole story about Heavenly Blues? How'd you get the concept?
So the basic concept came from, there's an Irish proverb, may you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. And the first genesis of the idea was based off that phrase. I was thinking like, oh, what if you had half an hour to break into heaven and then the devil comes after you? And so it very much moved away from that, but that was the first kernel of what if there was a heist story in the afterlife. So that was where it started, and then it just kind of morphed into this whole thing because the afterlife has always been a concept that has baffled and interested me because it so rarely makes any goddamn sense. So really, what it was like, it was just kind of having this, oh, thieves in hell, like rob heaven. That feels like a strong elevator pitch. And then just using that as a springboard to create a version of heaven and hell that I've wanted to do for so long and create a version that really answers all my questions about how any of this stuff fucking works. And also try to make a vision of the afterlife that feels like, for lack of a better word, a living place, a culture and a city and a world outside just the goddamn torture dimension.
Oh, that was one of the things that really struck me, especially in the first issue, the first few pages, the guy in the office that's shot and goes to hell. And, you know, the scene where Isaiah is pouring the molten gold on him in the pit. And there's this kind of a dialogue. And it's like, and then Aaron comes in and they're talking about torture, torment. And, you know, they give let's talk about all of this torture and torment. This has nothing to do with retribution or paying really for the sins. It's just, we're doing this just because we can. It's like,
yeah, absolutely. That was just because the fuck you and the fuck else am I going to do?
It's almost like rookie hazing.
Oh, it's absolutely rookie hazing. And the idea that they're just tortured until they can't feel pain is actually something that's going to come up and be plot like several times throughout the plot. That is one of the tricks up their sleeves, is just the fact that they're going up against people in heaven and they've gone through this absolute unending nightmarish torture until they've reached a place that nobody else in the afterlife that who hasn't gone through that can understand.
Yeah, and I kind of like how you set it up, like Jay was mentioning, like in the first few pages. I mean, the first pages are, you know, it's just some guy, I guess there's a disgruntled worker, he comes in, shoots him and kills him, and he starts like he's, you know, no fault of his own, he's sitting there working, minding his own business, gets killed, and he's kind of floating up to heaven, then all of a sudden he's in hell, and you kind of go through the dialogue, and it's almost like, You don't know what he did to deserve to be there. He doesn't really know, and you get to know the characters, and it's almost like humans are so imperfect, they're going to end up in hell anyway.
In the first draft of the script, it did go into more detail about what that guy did. In the first draft, he was an embezzler, like kind of just a scummy Wall Street type guy. But what it came down to was, do I really want to spend valuable panel space characterizing a character that is never going to show up again after page four?
Well, exactly.
And also, again, sorry.
I kind of like it like this. You don't know what he did.
I agree. And I think it just speaks to, like, kind of a cynical nature of humans, which, yeah. But also, I think he can become more of a blank slate and really becomes a better, the unknowing, the kind of, that his backstory is unknown makes him a better foil for Isaiah to kind of imprint his personality on. And I think it helps make Isaiah's introduction a little bit stronger.
Very good. So how many issues is this planned? Do you know? Did you say 6 issues?
Yep, it's going to be 6 issues. I just got the cover in for issue 6 yesterday, and oh, I am excited to release that online once I can. It feels good having something that I can't show.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it does.
Like, I want to, but I can't, but it feels good that I can't. It feels like, ooh, I've gotten to the point where I can't show stuff. Like, that feels like a milestone.
Yes, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think you've got 3 issues that are out.
2 that are out. The third comes out in 2 weeks, so it comes out
on the
27th is the third one, where you learn the backstory of the group's drug-addicted ninja, Hideki Iwata. Fun fact about Hideki, he is named after famous New York Yankee designated hitter Hideki Matsui. 2009 World Series MVP, baby. Go Yanks!
I didn't know that, and I'm a pretty good baseball fan, too.
I am, too, and I didn't catch that.
Only designated hitter to ever be awarded World Series MVP.
Nice.
Nice.
Think about how well he had to hit. He didn't even play half the games in the series, and they're still like, you were the best. And he was. Sorry. I've got wildly off topic there.
No. Everything's fair game here. So I don't know if this gives anything away, and it's not that I'm wanting for answers straight up for why, but I find it interesting, and I can't remember if it's now in issue 2, but I know they mentioned the Egyptians in issue 1. And it's the comment where heaven and hell were built on what the Egyptians built before. I find that intriguing. And I don't want to give anything away or whatever, but...
Oh, no, to me, that was just...
Hint?
Well, to me, that's just history.
Christianity. So there's no heaven and hell until Christianity, Judaism, and the Egyptians were beforehand, so they didn't have a hell, so it was just...
Yeah, the idea is, like, there was, like, where the angels and... There was, like, where the angels were all and demons were all hanging out. Then the Egyptians actually made, like, the land of the dead, and then Christianity came around, and the angels and demons were like, well, let's just take over this place. So just the idea that, like, there are religions older than the Christian conception of heaven and hell. So if this afterlife is real, why aren't any of the other afterlives real? And just try to give, like, if I'm giving credence to this interpretation, let me also try to, like, give credence to another interpretation and marry them together a little bit and give kind of, like, and kind of in that give, like, mysticalism to chronological history was the idea of just showing, and, like, since there are religions older than Christianity, like, and Judaism, like, show an afterlife older than when heaven and hell could have existed.
Oh, so we may see some Greek, Roman... I'm trying to think of some others, but okay, I see what you're. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying, and this kind of, you know,
you're not. You won't, but you could.
You could. Well, this kind of reminds me of my Dungeons and Dragons days when all the mythologies had their own different planes that you could travel to. Your afterworlds.
And that was also the idea of, especially in issue 2, where you get to explore a lot of, where you get to see so many different parts of hell. I wanted to give the indication and exactly like let readers imagine and view like an afterlife so much bigger than what they're seeing, and make it vivid enough that they can give detail to parts that aren't even in it, and they could think about how it would fit in into this carved up, sewn together jigsaw of a city that is hell in this world.
Yeah, and the occupants are the ones that become the torturers of the new entrants as they come. So I think because the comment was made that Aaron had first tortured Isaiah when he first came, and now he's graduated up to where he does it for the newcomers. And
exactly.
it's something that progresses, where the damned become the ones that do the damning.
Oh, yeah, and I think, again, that just speaks to, like you said, it's hazing. Like, you go through hazing and you hated it and you despised every second of it, and yet it gets to be your turn the next time and you get it then, and it becomes and you can't help yourself. So I kind of wanted to show just like, especially with the lack of purpose, that was a big thing that, like, to me, that's what makes hell torture, isn't the torture, it's the lack of meaning and purpose. So really just showing just like how just base it, without any kind of real meaning and purpose, just how wanton acts of pain and violence is just whatever. It's not like there's anything on TV tonight.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated with the creative process on this, because we're talking about these concepts and they make perfect sense to me. Like you said, it's like hell, you're there, there's no purpose. That's the true hell. Is this, I mean, how does this germinate? I mean, is this something you've been thinking about for a long time, or it's just, you know, lightning strikes in the middle of the night and it's like, hey.
No, this is like, I've had a lot of questions about the afterlife for a long time. I think that's because the afterlife wasn't a thing for me growing up. It wasn't a thing in my household. I'm Jewish, so it wasn't a thing we talked about in synagogue. It was like, Rabbi, what happens when you die? We bury you. What do you think happens? Next question. So I never got like told heaven and hell like as a real thing. So like I just saw it like in stories and movies, and people told me about what they heard in church. And every time I saw it, I'm like, hold up. I have so many questions. So it's just like the torture dimension. Why? Why would God make the torture dimension? You cheat on your spouse and you're just tortured forever. That's nonsense. It's nonsense. Also, who decides who's good or bad? They thought slavery was A-okay back then. Are you going to get to heaven and be like, and like, they're like fucking like, hey, we're the slavers. Turns out that was still a good thing. Like, whose metric are we on? Who is judging that? I don't want to go to a heaven determined by like first century morals. Does it get updated? Do they get revised? Do they go to the slavers who were in heaven and be like, hey, turns out people decided slavery's bad. Off to hell with you now. Like, who's deciding this? The Bible's fucked up. I can't trust that book's ethics. It's all about hitting women with jawbones and all sorts of crazy crap.
There's a lot to, I mean, gosh, you're talking
like,
about
questions
that philosophers have talked to you about for thousands of years.
And I'm like, that's in it. It's like, I can't listen to anybody that tells me to throw dead crows. I can't listen to any book that tells me to throw dead crows at sick people.
Yeah. No.
That was my bar mitzvah portion. My little sister got to do the story of Noah's Ark. I got a step-by-step guide for what to do if you have leprosy.
Oh, my gosh.
More on the business side, because I think you got your MBA, correct?
So yeah,
you kind of know how the business of this works from a different perspective.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to really understand the business side of it, and, you know, knowledge is power. I got my MBA this past May from NYU. And, it's good, especially because even in business school, you'd see how little is known about the comic book industry. And I think a lot more vocal business literacy would help the community.
Does this harken back to the days when the publishers would take advantage of artists and not give them credit or compensation for original characters they created?
Oh, abso-fucking-lutely. Ain't no one going to Siegel and Shuster me.
Well, plus, I know, especially with smaller press titles, we're starting to see creators that are actually getting more into the business side of it. I'm thinking, for example, Joe Pruitt at Aftershock, and I think Peter Cimetti.
James Pruitt is the publisher at Scout.
Right.
I work with Joe Pruitt's brother, like at Scout.
And yeah, it's true. I forgot about that. And I think Peter Cimetti at Alterna. Is there an interest? Do you have an interest of maybe getting into that aspect more into the business of being a publisher as well as creator?
Don't have plans or a vision for it right now, but I'm playing the long game. Just because I don't see a need for it at 27 doesn't mean I won't see a need for it at 47, and I'd rather have the knowledge and the info now than need to get it later when I need it.
Yeah, it's better to be prepared.
Right now, if I get to the point where I feel like I've accomplished what I want to do creatively and I want to look to do, like, take on new challenges in the industry. But right now, I'm giving it my all to just do as much creatively as I can in this medium. Business is for get a good day job so I can keep making comics.
Absolutely. Well, that's actually, no. Well, it's kind of a good segue talking about being creative. I'm not asking you to tip your hand on anything, but do you have any other, you got any other things in the pipeline right now that'll be coming out this year or later this year or next year?
Because it's not like I haven't. So right now my focus is really on Heavenly Blues. There's still a lot of work to go to finish that. Still some writing, and I'm also the letterer on it. So lettering the remaining issues is going to keep me plenty busy. But right now, at this point in my career, I'm at the point where I'm still financing, like, the actual art, because I believe that if I'm going to work with a professional artist, it's my responsibility to pay them a professional rate, even if it's out of my own pocket. And so right now, just where I am on the ladder, like, my stuff is self-financed, so just resources limits how much I can work on at a time. But I do have something cooked up with an incredibly talented artist named Alexandria Huntington. And I'm pretty excited for what that could turn into.
Sounds great.
So are you doing any of the show circuit? I know you're talking about having the books on the shelf and previews and everything, but
yeah. So I'm still kind of burnt out. I did a lot of shows this past this summer. I did Boston Comic Con. I did Wizard World Philadelphia, Five Points Comics Fest. I did Flame Con. I'm not tabling, but I'm going to SPX this weekend. Been doing some signings in New York. What other shows? Did Baltimore last year, but not doing it. But that's also this weekend, but not going because, again, I'm I need rest from the summer. Summer is my real big convention season. And my next show will be, I'm going to be at, I don't know how much I'll be at New York Comic Con, but I'll definitely be doing a signing at the Scout booth at New York Comic Con.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you going to the cons at the Scout booth, or are you doing it through tabling yourself?
So I think I might. I think I am going to have a table in the small press area on Sunday, but I think for the most part, the best place to find me will be at the Scout booth. During my, whenever my signings end up being scheduled for.
You going to be at E2C2 next year?
Oh man, I hope so. I was at that last year and that convention was phenomenal. I love C2E2. I would love to do that convention again. It is great.
That seems to be a favorite among a lot of people.
It's a really well run convention. It's great crowd, great people. It's I had a lot of fun at C2E2.
Dennis and I have a good friend who's going to be at the New York Comic Con. We're going to make sure he comes your way. Have him sign some stuff for.
So we'll be happy to put the John Hancock on him.
Okay, great. Don't have you got anything else, Dennis? You need it?
Well, I think we've talked about Shaman. We've talked about Heavenly Blues, kind of the themes and stuff behind it, kind of his thoughts going into it and everything, and some of the stuff he's got in the pipeline and where to find him. Where can people find you? Where can they get him if they don't have a local comic shop? Because you know, I kind of grew in the rural South and didn't really have one. Are there alternate ways of doing it? I think you can go to Scout Comics and buy it.
Absolutely.
Do you have a Facebook page and other places to buy?
You can find me on Twitter at BenTheCon. You can also find me on Instagram at BenTheCon. And you can find my website, www.benconcomics.com. There's links to buy physical copies or digital copies of Shaman. And also there's handy links right to the Scout store where you can buy physical copies straight from the publisher.
And don't you have a Etsy shop? I think that you're the first creator I found to have an Etsy shop.
Yes, that's right. That would be the best place to find the Shaman graphic novel, and you can find me at, again, BenCon Comics on Etsy.
Very good. Well, Ben, we really want to thank you for joining us, taking the time out of your schedule to join us and talk with us.
Thank you so much. I had a blast doing this. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We were glad to do it, and we hope to have you again when your next project comes out.
Would love to do it, for sure.
Yeah, and I think a bunch of us that are on this network go to E2C2. I didn't go this year, but I'm planning on going next year, so hopefully maybe I'll see you at E2C2 in 2018.
That would be awesome. I would love that. Again, thank you guys so much for having me.
Glad to do it.
And again, you can contact your local comic shop. The first two issues of Heavenly Blues are already out. And issue 3 is out September 27th.
And it's a well done comic. I mean, it's on very nice paper. This is not, Scout's done a good job with this.
Playing for keeps.
Yep. Okay.
Very cool.
So is that all we got tonight, Jay?
That's all I've got.
All right. Well, we'll be signing off. I guess we will see you next episode.
But yes, thanks for listening. And we look forward to you joining us again. Good night.
Good night.
That wasn't terrible.
That was pathetic. Boo.
Nerdy Legion.